Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. I mean, days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City,
the Shambhala New York podcast.
And I am Dave, your host. This is episode 112 of the podcast. You are listening yet again. You are getting very awake. You are getting very awake. Hey, today on the podcast, a very special episode. This was recorded from our weekly Dharma gathering a couple of weeks ago. Shastri Ethan Nickturn with special guest visiting teacher Sharon Salzberg, both co-teaching, co-presenting a talk called Real Love, Bringing the Path to Your Relationships. It's romantic relationships, all kinds of relationships, friendships, living in a world, living in a society with other people. How do we bring the path to relating to other people? But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Center of New York is presenting its introductory weekend intensive Shambhala Training Weekend 1, the weekend of October 28th with Lodro Rinzler. That's called Feel Human Again, Shambhala Training Weekend 1. This is an opportunity to deepen one's meditation practice or to dive in from the start. The weekend is comprised of a Friday night talk and a Saturday meditation intensive and Sunday half day final intensive and discussion. It is a powerful thing to engage in a weekend of meditation practice, and you should check it out. If you can't do the whole weekend, you can at least come see the Friday night talk to get a flavor, get a sense of it, get an overview. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org, click Classes and Programs, and go to Feel Human Again, Shambhala Training Weekend 1. October 28th, 29th, and 30th. And now, as you know, Shastri Ethan Nickturn is a senior teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition, teacher in residence in New York. He is the author of One City, A Declaration of Interdependence. He is also the author of The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. Sharon Salzberg is a longtime meditation teacher, a New York Times best-selling author. She is the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. She is the author of many books, including, among them, Real Happiness at Work, and a forthcoming book to be entitled Real Love, right on topic. Shastri Nickturn, as well, is also planning a book forthcoming on the topic of love. So, it's on their minds. It's buzzing. It's in the room. Maybe you spend your time thinking about love. So let's see what they have to say.
So the exploration of love. When my goddaughter, who's now 18, just left for college, when she was really like a little munchkin, she had a tiny part in a movie. She didn't have any lines. She barked because there was a talent show in the movie, and that was her thing in the talent show, to bark. But anyway, the movie was called Dan in Real Life. Did you ever see it? Anybody? And there was a line in the movie which I have quoted forevermore, which is something like, love is not a feeling, it's an ability. Love is not a feeling, it's an ability. And I've recently had some discussions with an editor who has said to me, well, of course it's a feeling. Everyone knows it as a feeling. You can't say it's not a feeling. So I've tempered that to something like, as well as knowing love is a feeling, we might know it as an ability, a capacity, because I think that is... there's something very crucial there, and there's something very empowering there. I had an experience. I went to Burma in 1985. I had begun my meditation practice altogether in 1971, and that was really mindfulness practice or insight meditation. And at the end of those retreats, we would do a little bit of formal loving kindness practice where we would offer well wishing to ourselves and to others. But it was almost like a ceremonial way to end the retreat rather than much of a practice. And I heard that there was such a practice and that you could really immerse yourself into it. And they say the Buddha taught it as the antidote to fear. That was intriguing. And that you could really undertake it as a whole part of your practice. But I never really had the opportunity to do that till I went to Burma in 1985. And I spent 3 months just doing loving kindness practice, and which I'll talk about in a minute. But I had this experience, which I keep thinking is like one of those experiences that as you try to describe in words, it sounds like nothing much, but it was completely revolutionary for me. And it was really along those lines. It was something like I realized experientially in a more kind of embodied way that my whole life I had thought of love as like a package or a commodity in the hands of someone else. It's like the UPS person who was going to deliver it to me one afternoon. But if that person changed their minds and turned around on the doorstep, I'd be bereft. There would be no love in my life. That it was all really in the hands of someone else to deliver unto me. And something just switched, and I realized, no, actually, it's within me. Other people may spark it, or enrich it, or nourish it, or threaten it. But it actually is a capacity inside of me. That's why I love that line in the movie so much, which I heard it many years later, when I heard it many years later. And that really is the whole, I think, fundamental basis of understanding of why we might undertake something like loving kindness practice. I find that there are, well, first, the word loving kindness, as many of you know, is the common translation of the word metta, M-E-T-T-A, in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, Maitri in Sanskrit. I've had several scholar friends say to me, why don't you just call it love? You're so timid, you're so squeamish. Just say love, you know? But love is so complicated, isn't it? Like, what in the world do we mean when we say love? So often we clearly mean some kind of medium of exchange, like I will love you as long as you love me in return, or as long as the following 15 conditions are met. And I was teaching somewhere, and I said that, and someone in the room called out, only 15? I would love myself as long as I never make a mistake, you know? And we know that state, the fragility, the breakability. It's not really what is meant by metta. And so there's something about connection, right, that is, it's the recognition that our lives have something to do with one another. That the construct of self and other and us and them, which we labor under the rigid holding to that, it's just a construct. Right? Like, who's sitting here in this room? You or you and all those people who brought you in some way? Another thing that happened to me just recently, because when I was working on this last book, I spent a lot of time meeting with people, and I say, tell me your love stories. And there was one love story, which I just have to tell, which I turned in the book the evening of July 31st. I was in England. It was due August 1st, a year ago. But anyway, other than that minor year problem, I turned in a little early. And just before I pressed send, I thought, oh God, I forgot that story. Which I thought was just this fabulous story, and I put it in right away, and then I pressed send. So I'm imagining I forgot a lot of things, and that there'll be more changes down the pike. But anyway, the story was the first group I did about love. And somebody in the room said, most people consider a good relationship to be 50-50. My dog and I, we're 100-100. And I went, whoa, that's great. And so I remembered it, really. It was like my finger was hovering over that button. I'm like, whoa, no, put that in. So I learned a lot in that whole process. So one of the much later groups I did, somebody said to me that his whole life he'd sort of been brought up with the idea that to like somebody was like an ordinary run-of-the-mill thing. Like, of course, we like everybody. But to love somebody was really like an awesome, unusual, extremely rare state. And he looked at me and he said, you're reversing it. And I thought about it and I said, you're right. I am saying that I believe we have a capacity to connect to everybody, to care, to consider that everybody counts. Everybody matters, and we might not like them at all. And we shouldn't force ourselves to like them. We might have that sense of connection and care, and we might decide, I'm never inviting you to dinner, or I'm not supporting you. I'm not going to try to see you get your way. In fact, I'm going to do the opposite with as much intensity as I can muster. But that doesn't necessarily destroy that sense of connection. So it's odd, isn't it? Turning it all around. And what do we usually think of love? We think of it as the form of the connection. It's unimaginable to us that we might say, I feel this profound acknowledgement of caring and connection, and my discernment, my intelligence, my wisdom, to whatever degree I have wisdom, tells me the only really appropriate response in the actual real configuration of how we are relating to one another is a tremendous boundary. It's saying no. It's being really fierce. It's not having contact, whatever it might be. And yet, this is actually the prospect that is apparent in an unfolding of when you really examine what something like love might mean within the Buddhist tradition. It's not liking, it's not saying we are meant to, you know, walk off into the sunset together. That may be true with some people, but not with everybody. And that's what people always ask, like, if you're saying I have to love everybody, does that mean, like, I have to feel exactly the same way, you know, and, like, toward that kid as I feel toward my kid or whatever. And it's not that exactly, but it's that deep knowing that our lives have something to do with one another, and that for all we look through others as though they don't count, for all we discount people, for all we objectify people, for all we don't care, it's both not the real world. It's a construct. It's a pattern of conditioning, and because of that, it kind of violates the truth, which means we suffer. And not only do we suffer, but we cause suffering. So I had a tremendous adventure exploring this book, and of course, when we do the weekend, we'll have much more time to we'll both be in a whole other stage of editing by then. And you know, so what does that mean when we talk about ourselves? What does it mean to really love ourselves? What does it mean to love another, whether it's a partner or parent or a child or a friend or a neighbor or your dog? And what does it mean to have love for all beings in a way that is not a weakness or sentimentality, but is really a force that's onward leading and very, very powerful? So that's my introduction to the topic.
You want me to talk?
I want you to talk now.
Okay. Is there anyone here? There's a term in the nonprofit world called founder's syndrome. Has anybody heard this term before?
Yes.
Founder syndrome, as someone who founded a nonprofit organization, as two people who founded nonprofit organizations, and as someone who works for Shambhala, which is a nonprofit organization with an incredibly strong founder presence in Chogyam Trungpa, this is what this describes is that any community organization, when the initial person who brought that community together leaves, there's a confusing period where it's hard to figure out what the community or the organization represents beyond the strong presence of the founder. So, and the other side of that is that when you're looking at a path of awakening and mindfulness and compassion like Buddhism, it's a very individual human thing. So I think Buddhism actually, as a spiritual tradition, has a very strong case historically of founder syndrome, which is that a lot of times the story of the historical Buddha's awakening is treated like it has to be everyone's story. And the Buddha lived in a very different time, a very different place, and his story is... It's a real loner's story. Among the versions, among the infinite stories of awakening that are probably possible, it has a real kind of libertarian, I like to use the phrase sometimes, spiritual libertarian twist, right? Leave the world behind, which really means leave relationships behind. That's all the world is. It's not a place, right? The world is just where more people are relating to each other. And the forest was, for him, where fewer people were relating to each other, and work with your own mind. And it's just really a huge part of my practice to notice, because we all are alone with ourselves, how important that story is and how universal it is, and at the same time, how not universal it is. And how particular to one particular path that notion of being by yourself and awakening in solitude is. I'm also, it's becoming increasingly apparent to anybody who's studying meditation alongside any kind of interest in any of the more scientific fields of study, that the notion that any of us is alone in sort of crafting our experience is totally false. That, somebody like Ayn Rand, the sort of literary mother of libertarianism, would be totally decimated. Every view she held would be utterly destroyed by just one conversation with a modern neuroscientist or a modern specialist in attachment theory, right? This sort of notion that you're in it on your own. It's false, right? So we sit here on the cushion. One, why aren't you all sitting alone at home right now? Why did you come here? You could meditate at home, right? What, I mean, it's an interesting question. Like, why did I come here to work with my own mind in silence with a bunch of other people? There's some acknowledgement of relationship. And there's, as Sharon's putting out, when we sit, even if you do manage to sit at home, you bring everybody who's ever influenced you to the cushion with you. So... that notion of working with our own mind, which is the cornerstone of this tradition, is incredibly important. But relationships and the fact that our mind is, our sense of self is completely crafted in relationships is the basis of any path a human being could have. I said in The Road Home that it would probably be a lot easier to wake up if you were the only person in the universe. First of all, like, social media would be incredibly boring. Can you imagine that if all you had to look at was your own feed? Like, how quickly you would get bored? maximum number of likes, one. I don't know. Would you still like your own thing if you were the only person? That's an interesting question. But it would be easy to get awakened, I believe, because you just would know whose stuff everything that happened was, right? There would be no question of like, so this very critical thought, is this because of my parents? Is this because of my last failed romantic relationship? Is this because of the culture I was educated in? I'd just be like, no, I'm the only one here. Right? And the interesting thing about a modern path of awakening in a city of almost 9 million people and a society of 7 billion people is it has to take into account relationships. And as much as we have to pay attention to our own minds, we also have to pay attention to how we interact in relationship. And I was actually thinking about this, just I didn't want to say too much tonight because Sharon's here and I'm here all the time. But that the beginning of the ability of love that Sharon talked about is the act of mindfulness. That's the... And it's not the same thing as liking, because it's actually an act of love, because you to give something or someone your attention, including yourself, you don't have to like that person to give them your attention, but you just have to be present. And to me, that's actually the seedling of the toolkit of the ability to care. That's the way I think of, I mean, there's all these different, in Western scholarship, there's a long tradition of, you know, the difference, there's different words in Latin for sort of the divine love or camaraderie of friendship versus erotic or romantic love. But they're all held together by some kind of caring. And I also think a big part of this is that we have to be on a path of love, we also really have to undercut, and I think this is a really important part for me, the story that desire is a bad thing. That desiring a friend or a romantic partnership or desiring a teacher or desiring your children or desiring your puppy. A lot of times in both Western and Eastern thought, this notion that I want something or I long to connect with another being is made problematic. And really, I think there's another way of looking at desire, that it's always an act of wisdom. Why? Because in any act of desire, there's the acknowledgement that the world and the universe is actually bigger than just me. I think it's a very narcissistic thing not to experience desire for another person, actually. And I think we all experience some form of wanting to connect, and that sort of making friends with how that works, mindfulness of that, and that the relationship of that to love is actually a huge part of our practice. So I do think... I often, when the teachings translate that the Buddha said the cause of suffering was desire, I say that's not what he meant. That's not the right word to use. I mean, we all have our own relationship to these words, but that notion that it's okay to long for connection, and it's okay to long for connection to yourself and to others, and that might actually be the seed of awakening rather than the root of our whole problem, is a really interesting and powerful thought.
You're quite the rebel. That's not what he meant. I mean, I agree with you, but that's really cute. Well, you know what I think of when I hear you, that last thing that you just said? How it's a kind of fundamental tenet of the teaching that the Buddha said that all beings want to be happy. Mm-hmm. And for many of us, the word happiness equates to being conflict avoidant or avoiding the very real suffering that exists or being like giddy or superficial. And it seems like craving. And so people often say, well, I don't think it's okay to want to be happy. But really, first of all, there's a whole other meaning of happiness. And also, that urge toward happiness is not considered a problem. That's considered, in some ways, it's like the best thing about us. Because if our own urge to be happy can be aligned with wisdom rather than with ignorance about where happiness is actually to be found, then it becomes like a homing instinct for freedom, and we can cut through many obstacles. And it's not singular. It's not like only I deserve to be happy, you know? Forget about you. It's like all beings want to be happy, which I think has a certain undertone of all beings actually should be happy. That would be right. And it is so hard to figure out how to actually be happy because we have so many myths and so much confusion thrown at us and so many distortions. You know, if you only accumulated endlessly, you'd be happy. Or, you know, one of the interesting things about connection, and there's some study that says that if somebody gives you, I don't know what this, you know, exact amount was in the study, like $15 and you're told to only spend it on yourself, or you're told to only spend it on someone else, the people who spent it on other people actually reported more happiness than the ones who had to spend it on themselves. It's very hard to figure out what really makes us happy. It's not obvious by any means. And I consider that a very powerful spiritual question, rather than thinking I shouldn't be happy and it's not right and it's too selfish. And, even the Dalai Lama said something like, before his English got as good as it is, something like, if you want to be happy, if you want to be selfish, be a wise selfish. In other words, if you consider wanting to be happy selfish, figure it out. You know, so you actually can be happy. And if you're happy, you have some energy. And that energy translates to generosity and to caring and being able to pay attention to somebody else rather than being exhausted and feeling broken and, you know, and all shut down. So it's a pretty good thing to be happy. So certainly there are myths in every direction, right? Like the myth of the founder. Mm-hmm. that particular founder that you've got to kind of weave your way alone, more alone. But then all the myths that are attendant upon relationship itself, right? Mm-hmm. So do you cover that in your book?
Yeah. Well, I'm using the perfect modern undercutting of myth of romantic happiness, which is the movie The Princess Bride, which is best.
Which I've never seen.
Best movie.
Have you all
of
seen
the
it?
20th
who's
century.
Seen it? Okay, who's yeah. not seen it? So you got to address that. Unless you have a disc.
Well, they can read your book.
So what does The Princess Bride say?
Well, it's The Princess Bride is it's a very goofy fairy tale that's about it both completely undercuts the idea of sort of romantic salvation, but still embraces true love, which I think that's a really interesting critical and deconstructs a lot of our myths, but at the same time it doesn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. And I think that's one way I think about it is that we do live in a lot of myths of relational salvation in our world. And, you know, I think those can be summarized with sort of the romantic comedy myth, which is really interesting because it's always, I feel like, or there's often this combination of like, if I get the right relationship, I will also have a comfortable status in the world, which is an interesting sort of, it's really interesting. I find that the confused mind so often works by sort of mushing together things that don't really need to go together, right? That romantic happiness means the world likes me. It's like, those are two different questions. I also think we do this in other ways, like the thought that if I wish someone happiness, it means I want them to be president, right? Those are two completely separate discussions. Please practice for all the presidential candidates and then choose who is qualified to run a country. Two separate conversations. So on the one hand, I think we do have this myth, and some people are not into this myth, but I can tell you from experience, the myth must subsist because vendors really do raise their prices when they find out it's a wedding. So they must know that we live in this myth of, like, this is more important than anything else. If you have the perfect relationship, you will be saved. So you're willing to pay for that.
Really? What, like, what kind of vendor?
Just the caterer. Or the,
oh.
Not the officiant. The officiant. No, no.
Oh, if I'd only known.
That's actually, among friends, that's actually, you're not supposed to tell them at first that it's for a wedding if you want an honest bid. Because of the myth of romantic salvation.
Wow. I never knew.
And so there's, we live in that kind of world, and then I think there's, on the other extreme, because we know that that sort of savior, right? Has anyone here ever had a relationship save you? And when I say save you, I mean like that you didn't have to show up to life after that relationship ensued. That's what savior means. It's like, I'm done, I'm safe, you know, drop mic, everything's great. And so we kind of know inherently, and this is why I think Buddhism, from a spiritual standpoint, is such a powerful tradition, because it's sort of, every form of Buddhism I've ever studied serves to kind of undercut the idea that somebody's going to save you. Right? It also provides the optimism that you don't actually need that, which is good. It's not just like, nobody's going to save you, so tough luck. It's like, nobody's going to save you, and you're going to have to work with your own situation. So we know kind of that that's not going to work in some intuitive way, even if we still grasp after it. But then the other extreme is sort of like, this is never, nothing's going to work. There's no point to relating. I'm just going to get hurt again. And it's interesting because there's certain, in classic Buddhism, again, going by this founder syndrome, especially when it talks about friends, there's a lot of texts and a lot of laments that, like, friends have let me down, you know? The world is a place of confused people. Don't rely on anything but the supreme teachings of the Dharma. You know, in the Tibetan tradition, classic Tibetan tradition, there's a lot of sort of like, are you really that cynical about relationships that the guru is the only person who's ever cared about you? It strikes me, outside the narrative of this tradition, it often strikes me as like, that's really sad that a person felt there was only one person they could ever connect with fully. But this is the same kind of cynicism, I think, that we experience when we get really down on the idea of relationship, you know? There's people in this room, Valentine's Day is your favorite day of the year, and there's people, it's your least favorite day of the year. Screw Cupid, you know? There's a lot of anti-love poetry readings in this city on Valentine's Day.
I didn't know that either. So much I don't know.
You should spend more time in Brooklyn.
I guess I should.
Although they're probably moving to Queens now. That's a little too far in the other direction, right? Because it's sort of saying connection and salvation are two different things. Again, the idea is, if salvation doesn't work, this is what the cynic thinks, what's the point of trying to connect? So this idea of the middle path between the cynic's take on relationships and the sort of savior take on relationships, I think, and finding that is really has been really important in any type of relationship. And I think that has to do with, I think we have this with spiritual mentors sometimes, where you want somebody in the world to be perfect. And then when you get up close enough to actually see, I'm sure this happened with the Buddha. This is, again, like I'm sure there was some student, it's not in any of the sutras, where it's like the Buddha like picks his nose and it's just gross. Something like that must have happened. And then the person's like, what's the point of studying Buddhism? It's really interesting how we go back and forth in so many aspects of our relational life between, this is it, I found it finally. I have been so confused for so long, and I found the savior, the guru and the soulmate kind of have a similar narrative from that standpoint, right? And then we go to the other extreme, which is screw everybody, basically. I'm gonna handle this alone. And if right in the sweet spot, in the middle of those, which is where all of the Buddhist teachings lie, is what if we show up, give our attention, connect to ourselves in our own practice, connect to others in whatever relationships do it for us, whatever relationships we seek based on where we're at, and we connect and we practice that middle. And I think the interesting thing about the middle path is it's a little bit more like pinball than walking a tightrope. My path has really been, in every kind of relationship, has been kind of bouncing off those two extremes of salvation, cynicism. In the Shambhala teachings, talk about these extremes as hope and fear, which are kind of two sides of the same coin. We even have sort of mascots. Are people familiar with the Garuda? This mythical winged creature that originally comes from Hindu folklore, but really cool kind of figure. And the Garuda is supposedly the one who is beyond hope and fear, lives in the sky, doesn't need those strict reference points of, is the world for me or against me? Is this my savior or my enemy? Can sort of, as my father likes to say, hang out in space. Which I think is a really good skill for relationships. Are we friends? Are we, right? Are we ending this? Do you like me right now? Or, I don't know. Let's see what happens. The cynic and the person seeking salvation doesn't really want to do either of any of that, right? They're finding a way not to hang out in space. So.
Wow. You know what I also thought of? Even though, one could easily see the presentation of the sort of mythic, thank you, Buddha, having left home and then living in the forest with the monastics as a symbol of kind of intense aloneness. There actually, there's a story about this one time, because monastic life is a community life, actually, you know, and there were these quarrelsome monks somewhere who were giving him a hard time. And they were finding each other a lot. They were disputing all these different things, and so he went off to the deeper into the forest. He left them, and he went deeper into the forest for 3 months with only the company of an elephant and a monkey. And I always thought that was such a cute story, especially as a founder of an organization. And I thought, sometimes you just want to like leave that behind and just go into the forest with an elephant and a monkey. So there are all these gradations of, you know, aloneness. And I think, you know, one of the things I really tried to make a point of in writing the book is that connection is an inner state, and it manifests in a whole variety of different ways. And some of those beings, you know, like hermit type beings, like if you'd ask them, and people did ask them, why did you go off and meditate intensively alone for so long? And they'd say, I did it out of love for all beings. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, because they felt that that was their contribution to the world, actually. It wasn't because, you know, I'm so disappointed in everybody and I didn't get what I wanted for Valentine's Day. And, you know, it was like a bad year. And I did it out of love for all beings.
Right.
But the activity doesn't fit our concept of connection.
So I also want to be clear, and I guess I want to ask you that I'm not... The Buddha's story, even if you're not going to leave the world behind, is still incredibly useful. Even it's the same way, like, not every story you read has to be your story. That's why
that's
people
right.
read, right? So,
yeah.
Or go to the movies. I have some thoughts, but how do you think that story of leaving the world behind is useful to a person who's like, I want to be a Buddhist or a meditator in the world, in relationship? How do we make use of that moment he leaves the palace?
Well, he leaves the palace because he, according to the myth, you know, and it is all legend, but legend has its own power, right? And so... he leaves the palace because he awakens to the truth of suffering. Mm. And he realizes that what he's bought into all his life, he's 29, what he had bought into up until that point in his life was not true. And so it was the recognition of the suffering in life and the universal vulnerability. You know, the story is that he left the palace grounds the age of 29, he saw an old person, a sick person, a corpse, and a mendicant, someone who'd left the world seeking a deeper truth. So, and he asked his charioteer, say, seeing the sick person, does that happen to everybody? Is that going to happen to me? And the charioteer said, yes. You know, so it was a real opening into the truth of suffering that demanded he find another way. So I don't think... my other way has to look exactly like his other way. But I think it does demand that kind of recognition.
Yeah.
And not just the endless pursuit of pleasure, which is what he'd done before.
Right.
According to the myth.
Yeah. I also take it as you do need to leave the world behind.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yeah.
Need to... How many people here, I'm just wondering, and feel free not to answer, are scared of doing a meditation retreat, like a weekend or going away for a week with Sharon or with me? Like, it's like, oh, that's, would I be the same when I came back? Like, can I check my email? No one? All right, well. How many people were scared before your first retreat? This sounds like, this is so...
How many people would be afraid to be silent for a weekend?
Silent, also, just so we're clear, 1971 silence, when you started practicing silence, just meant no speaking, but now it also means no devices. That's a form of noise from this perspective. How many people would be, now with that in mind, would be scared to be silent for a whole weekend?
Yeah, right.
It doesn't have to, but that's right. It's like, oh, I still get to speak this way, right? I feel like the 1971 version of having smartphones is like if you could go on meditation retreat but watch television, too. It's like, no, you go on retreat, but you watch TV.
No, it's true. Ethan and I have a habit when we... when we meet for dinner, we always start out by tweeting, you know, having dinner with @EthanNichtern. And we were in some restaurant somewhere, and we were, you know, each in our phones, and somebody recognized him and came up to us and said, are you two going to talk to each other at all? Or are you going to just spend the whole dinner on your phones? And I was like, oh. No, it's true.
So
Well, it's true. I mean, we are challenged to not just live in the way we've always lived because we're used to it.
Yeah.
You know?
I guess the point I'm making in terms of how the Buddha leaving the world and the palace story is still useful to me as somebody who's not doing that with his life is that I take it as a lesson that if we're going to relate to other people, we can't be scared to relate to ourselves. There would be some fundamental imbalance if we only related to other people. And so I think that's, we have to do both. That for me as a modern practitioner is really the lesson is there has to be a period of time where each of those is a practice. And sometimes that literally means being alone.
I think one of the most profound spiritual questions we ever ask ourselves is, what do I really need right now in order to be happy? Like, do I need a bigger apartment, really? And am I willing to actually compromise what I would have to compromise in order to get it? But we don't usually think about that part. Mm. We just think about what we think we need. And if we can hold it in balance, like maybe I don't need that so badly, or maybe the cost is really too high in order to get that one thing, then we feel so free, you know, like we don't have that kind of fixation. Like, I will only be happy once I get this thing or I have this happening. And I think the world really does open up when we can let go in that way. Fun. Okay. So, what happens? Do we have a microphone for them?
Philip has a microphone. So we're going to do a little discussion, questions, comments.
The idea of the phone seems to be so isolating and not relating to the other person. You're not get out of the energy of the other person if you're in a mechanical device. But do you feel that the mechanical device in that way gives you some energy, some strength that the other person couldn't?
Yeah, we spent a whole night talking about this, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Buddha with a smartphone?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the idea of a phone feels so isolating, right? And is it the case that using your phone or being sort of locked in your phone gives you energy, or does it take you towards people or take you away from people? Is that a fair way of rephrasing what you're saying? Yeah. The thing that I find interesting about our technological era, which is only going to get weirder, by the way, like much weirder, is what it means to be with somebody in this relationship space is changing, you know? So, like, it literally used to mean, like, this, we all came here tonight, this still exists, hopefully this will keep existing. Sometimes I think, like, 50 years from now, everybody in this room will just be in a pod in your apartment, which will only be large enough for your body, because if your entire experience is virtual, why would you need more than that? That could be where we're going if we don't decide to do something else. But we all came here, and this is an actual physical space. And we're not tweeting at each other right now. So there's a sense that we are here together. So we're trying to be present with each other in some form. I think the virtual world changes the idea of space. So I think you could say, well, actually, I'm trying to be present with the person I'm texting. And then there's the question of who are you trying to really be present with? Who are you trying to be in the space with? So I think it really comes down to intention and attention. And that's the part that I really struggle with is it my intention to be with the person here or the people here? And as long as I'm clear about that in the moment, I think the device could be really helpful. And are we, is Georgia still here? Yeah. We often live tweet these talks, which it's always interesting to hear Georgia's interpretation of what I say in 140. But that's a way to invite more people into the space in some way. So I think it has a positive side. But yeah, you're right. If you're that one person on the street who's not doing it for that block, It looks very, very weird to see. Yeah, it has a downside for sure. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking about love, which doesn't seem to be spoken about much. And I just wanted to share, like, these are Helen Keller's basic words when she had her awakening, and she literally said, "In that moment, unlocked the prison door of my mind and opened wide the windows of my soul, like the sun breaking on a sleeping world."
Mm.
That's kind of amazing.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I have a two-part question, and, you know, one is I'm going through a sense at this point in time of an awakening myself, but it has been more like they say sometimes the shell of the seed must crack or shatter before the seed plant begins to grow. So awakening sounds, you know, sort of like nice, but it can be a shattering experience that leads to the awakening. And when you awaken, it's like you can be very vulnerable, very like frightened and scared. I mean, so you can say, wow, I'm awakening, but at the same time, it's like I've lost my orientation. And I was just wondering if you could say something about the reality, like, why am I feeling so frightened and scared if I just awaken? And then the other half of the question is, with all of this attention, like the Buddha and this, that, and the other thing, a feeling that I have is that maybe attention should be placed on the education of young children. Mm-hmm. So when they're growing up, they are having love, a little empathy, compassion, self-expression modeled to them. And as like Suzuki said, it could be imprinted in the first 5 years of life like languages. But I was wondering, at this point in time, stories are shifting. If the story could be shifted onto making children in that early childhood education the most valuable thing, then there would be a whole generation growing up mm-hmm. that felt confidence and loving. And Plato called it, you know, the acorn, the emergence. So whatever you could say about any sure. of that is greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thank you. I think in terms of the second point, there is a lot, I feel, you know, there's a lot of movement toward trying to introduce different curricula into schools, mindfulness and compassion training. There are all kinds of things that are going on, not everywhere, of course, but more and more. And I once saw this, like, little, maybe five-year-old girl in a news show about mindfulness in her school, and she said, "Mindfulness is the best thing in my life so far." And I thought, mine wow. too, you know, like, and they're taught, you know, like, there's a little peace corner, and when you're freaked out or you're anxious, you go into the corner, and there are only certain things other kids are allowed to say to you when you're in the corner, because they know you're there to chill, you know, and they can't make fun of you, or, like, you know, it's beautiful, and it's not as widespread, of course, as we would like, but it's growing. It's certainly growing more than when I was a child, for example, you know, so I think it is a tremendous thing. In terms of your experience, I think that a lot of what happens is that we do have these openings, and then it takes sometimes, you know, a fair amount of time to integrate them. And it's more, it's like a maybe a breakthrough experience, but it's not really integrated, so it's not, like, grounded. And needs to get grounded, ultimately, in ordinary life, so we can go to the grocery store and look at that checkout person and actually wish them well, you know, and not feel that it's overwhelming in some way. And so that's a place where people usually really get a lot of benefit out of a teacher or a community, you know, so that there's somebody who is actually very aware of that path, and that all the ways we tend to have an experience that is genuine, and then maybe we hold on to it, or, you know, there are all kinds of things we do just out of habit, or, you know, we wait for it to happen again, or whatever it is. And so working with a teacher, or having a group of like-minded people who are part of that path. I think it's just, it's priceless. And, you know, I look back at my life and I think of the tremendous good fortune, including the community aspect, which I completely took for granted. You know, I went to India. I started practice in this intensive 10-day retreat. And many of my closest friends I met in that first retreat in 1971. And, you know, we had a tremendous adventure together. We weren't always on retreat, but it was that sense of discovery and learning and trying to integrate and trying to bring forth our practice and into our daily lives. And it was enormous. And then I came back and we started teaching, some of us, and it was like, it didn't really occur to me, you know, that people were like getting up on Monday morning and going to work, and maybe there was nobody at work that they felt really shared their values, and then they were coming home and they were all alone, and they were like, you know, it took a long time to realize, oh, that is such an important component. And we had it, it just happened that we had it. And other people really need to think about creating that or finding it, because it will make a big difference.
I really enjoyed both of your presentations enormously, and I'm glad I came tonight. I've really been going over in my mind, I've opened this up for questions as to whether to ask this and whether I need to ask it, but I will do so. Sharon, your first thing you said is that love is not a feeling, it's
an ability.
It's an ability. And I get that, and I appreciate that. I've thought about that for many, many years. I'm married 47 years. It's been a real, that's been a practice for sure. But, and for me, to get in touch with the feeling of love has been actually a lifelong journey, because I had a lot of difficulty in my childhood, so I couldn't really get in touch with love. Now, that's something that is really a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. So for me, it being a feeling is very important. And I'm what I'm reflecting on as you were speaking, and I knew I'd be getting the mic in a few minutes, was that I think the feeling of love is, to be in touch with that is really, really important. And sometimes it can just be really, really large, a really large feeling. Romantic love, I'm not talking about romantic love per se, but it can also ebb to be something more in the background. Mm. But as you were talking, I think I was getting away. I wasn't hearing the feeling wasn't being stimulated as you were talking, but I take it for granted, or I assume we're talking about love throughout this entire talk and the different ways it manifests. And I guess it comes and goes, it rises and it falls. I guess that's what I'm hearing you both of you talking about, in effect, and the circumstances in which it'll arrive or which it'll retreat.
Well, sometimes one of the reasons I challenge the idea of love as an emotion, although of course it is a feeling, is because I think we can be in a state of profound connection, but it may not match our idea of an emotion. And I feel like, you know, especially in the practice where people are kind of cultivating this state, I think we can have a big switch in worldview and a sense of inclusion and understanding that's incredibly tender. You know, it's not like it's cold. It's got this tremendous tenderness and this sense of, wow, here we are together. You know, but it may not match kind of our concept of that particular emotion. And so I've seen people kind of disparage their practice and say they're not having the right experience and it's not good enough. And, you know, I mean, one story I tell a lot, because I think if you're doing loving kindness practice as a meditation, one of the cautionary notes I always use is I say, you may not see the change in your, say, 20 minutes a day of meditation or 10 minutes a day of meditation. But if you look at your life, you'll see you're a different person. You're different with yourself, you know, when you've made a mistake. You're different meeting a stranger. You're different with your partner, you know. You're different in a situation of adversity. We used to be like really rigid. And so one of the stories I tell is about this guy who came to me in New York and he took me out to lunch, and it was like this confessional lunch. And he said, you know, I just have to confess something. So I said, well, what? And he said, I've been doing loving kindness meditation for about 3 years now, and it's my practice whether I'm sitting at home or I'm on retreat. And he said, I have to say that my experience in sitting today is not that different than it was 3 years ago when I started. He said, but I'm like a completely different person. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm different with myself. I'm different with my family. I'm different ethically. I'm different with my community. And then he looked at me and he said, is that enough? Mm. And I said, yeah, I kind of think it's enough, you know? But, and it's actually a double-edged sword, I think, because sometimes people can have a very fixed idea that the feeling of love makes us weak, right? And it brings us down, and we lose judgment, and that makes you give in too much and, you know, compromise too much. That means you're going to support some presidential candidate you don't really want to support, you know, because you stumbled upon this feeling of love. And sometimes we have all kinds of ideas about that feeling. But I think if we more sense it as this capacity, then I think it's more empowering, you know, than to think I will be brought to my doom, you know, by this. I will inadvertently vote for the wrong person, mm-hmm. or stay in the wrong relationship. Mm-hmm. Or whatever it might be.
I'm struck by how even the practices that are about loving kindness are presented as solitary. Mm. And just recently I started discovering some actual interpersonal forms of meditation. And I've been blown away by them. And I'm wondering if they have any precedent in the more traditional Buddhist cultures. And if not, why not? Or mm-hmm. then just generally riffing as to mm-hmm. your mm-hmm. take on such practices.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there is precedent in Buddhist culture in the sense that monastic culture is communal culture.
Right.
You know, there are lots of rituals of asking of confession publicly, of asking forgiveness, of being given forgiveness. And even somewhat outside or joining the monastic culture to, you know, the rest of us, I discovered in bringing a Burmese meditation teacher to my center, the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, in 1984. He was a Buddhist monk, and he taught for 3 months. And at the end of the 3 months, the way he said goodbye was, he got up and he asked for an extended forgiveness. Mm. It was just the way he would say goodbye because it was coming to an end. Who knew what had been accumulated, you know, and actually plenty had been accumulated. And so it was a very complex scene. He'd never been to the West before. People who understood sort of the etiquette of taking care of a monk were all sitting, you know, leaving the poor staff to... I mean, it was a mess, really, which I could tell even in silence, you know. So when he got up and he said, if I've hurt or harmed you in any way, knowingly or unknowingly, I ask your forgiveness. And if you have hurt or harmed me, knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive you. I felt this tremendous relief. I felt like, oh, were I to go meet him again, he's not going to look at me and think, oh, you're the one who started that center where they don't even know how to treat a monk, you know? And I wasn't going to look at him and think, well, you're the one who came to the West all unprepared, you know? That we actually could begin again. So I know lots of couples who've undertaken that as a ritual, for example. So it's there, but you have to look for it. I also say that and more people are developing them and exploring them, and you know, in terms of communication and things like that. And for someone for whom it is moving or inspiring or suited, I think it's fantastic. I also recently spent some time with people who are kind of self-reported introverts, for whom that's torture. And they said, this one woman said to me, the four worst words you'd ever hear in a workshop begin with, now choose a partner. And honestly, if she heard those, she'd walk out the door.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it is very personal.
Do you want my favorite T-shirt?
What does it say?
It says, introverts unite, exclamation point, like almost like a rallying cry. And then under that, it says, we're here, we're uncomfortable, and we want to go home.
But I just love that. Now choose a partner. See ya.
But what's your name?
Miles.
Miles. I think this is a really powerful topic, the notion of the tools that can be employed more interpersonally or even communally. And this is a huge exploration of the Shambhala teachings. Like, what does it look like to move beyond the difficulty and transformative quality of just working with your own mind, which is hard enough, to try to establish some kind of shared practices or shared, you know, that's one of the things about the Shambhala teachings, is it's looking at what a society is. And from a certain standpoint, a society or a community is basically a series of shared rituals that people forget, you know, everybody's sharing a practice of being a New Yorker and just pretending something else is going on, right? But that's what a subway is, right? It's a shared practice space, and we can pretend that's not what's happening, and we can get really resentful that we are, you know, have to do this, but that's what it is. So I think as Sharon's saying, the tricky part is that it's really hard to, and that's the interesting, even the introvert, this is one of the things I'm talking about in my book, because the other theme of Princess Bride is introverts who become friends with each other. Even the introvert learned how to be an introvert from someone else. So even the introvert has heroes that they practice following after. You know, like maybe it's Kurt Cobain in our society or somebody like that. It's hard to establish the trust. Like, if I say that we're going to sit facing each other, like, we can do it because it's just you and me here. And we say, like, I'm going to wish you, like, may Miles be happy, free from suffering, and you're going to do that for me, and we're just going to have this awkward kind of, what would we call it, like a dharmic bromance moment. Maybe we could establish that trust or a friendship, and I'm using humor right now to try to build that, right? But it's much harder to do, right? And the subway, it's like 98% of the time we're like, get me out of here, you know? So if you want to, you could do a solitary practice in a group space as the next way you do it. I like doing this to be on the subway, if that's part of your daily or usual experience, and notice who you notice and wish them happiness. And then here's the fun part for me. Look at the person next to them who you didn't notice and do the practice for that person too. Just go left or right from the person you notice. And that's still solitary in the sense that you don't know that they're doing it again, but if enough people start doing it, eventually be like, are you doing loving kindness for me right now on the Q train? And then we could build something. And then it becomes, that's the interesting thing about the mirroring effect and the way we learn from each other, is then your practice becomes that much easier. You know, we use this in a lot of traditions. Loving kindness in the Theravadin system often starts with contemplating a benefactor, which is that bringing to mind a trust, like, I know this person has my back. I know this person loves. So I use that to prime my own practice. in the Shambhala tradition, there's visualizations of one's teachers or lineage, and so we use that, and it becomes it creates a huge support, you know. So it would be like, if that was just what you did going through the turnstile, it's just like, just wish everybody else commuting in New York City happiness and no unnecessary suffering today, and that was just part of the society you grew up in, you know. It would be much easier for a person coming of age in that society to experience the practice. So we're kind of, you know, the other interesting part of the Buddha's story is he was really interested in this notion of swimming against the stream, which is he really had this feeling, because he was the founder, that like not that many people want this path. So to take on this path of awakening is to go against the stream. But if the stream starts going with you, you're going with the stream to wake up. And that's the difference between solitary enlightenment and what we talk about in Shambhala as enlightened society. And it's much easier. You're just born enlightened eventually. That's what the another mythology, Shambhala was this Himalayan kingdom. And eventually, everybody just started going with the stream and it became an enlightened society. And then you just hang out in space. I don't know, watch movies, help people. I have a joke. Do you guys know Pokemon Go? That in an enlightened society, that app would be called Pokemon Go Help People. But some people really like that app, so it could be enlightened in and of itself. But that's what we're working with. It's just really, for the reasons Sharon points out, a lot of times we come to this path because we really have a hard time in relationships, so we need to create supportive spaces where you're not forced, because then it becomes like, for me, it becomes like the first day of high school all over again, and you don't want a meditation class to remind you of the first day of high school, you know? But I think it's a great direction to move in.
Hi. My question is about romantic love. I've always been taught that, you know, you really have to sort of love yourself before you can expect to give or receive love from somebody else. But at the same time, learning to really cultivate loving kindness towards yourself is a lifelong practice. And so I'm wondering if you could sort of comment on how to respect your own journey while still, I mean, I think it's human nature to want love from somebody else. Mm-hmm. So just, yeah, that balance.
I think this question of which outcome comes first is a big Buddhist question. I don't think it's one or the other. One, because then you'd have to be enlightened before your first date, right? What I think is, if you treat them both as practices that you're doing, and sometimes I'm always fascinated by which practices come easy and which practices have kind of more painful lessons. And sometimes the painful lessons happen when you have to work with yourself, and sometimes the painful lessons happen when you have to work with other people in a romantic space. And that has been my history, the latter. I think if you practice both simultaneously, but sometimes you might actually say, take that advice, like, no, I really have to, like, I have not learned the lesson in the romantic space, and maybe it's time to just really practice. But you can't make two, I have so many friends in my own personal experience, like, you make a rule, I am not doing that. For people have these weird, like, they just, I think they read some Instagram post or from some Instagram guru, like, don't date for a year, or it's like, or like, it's weird amounts of time. And then obviously What happens if you say, I'm not going to date anybody, I'm not going on any dates for a year? What happens on day three? Somebody awesome is just like, hey, Sophie. So then what do you do? And there's sometimes in Buddhist tradition you say, no, I took this vow, I made this commitment, let's see the practice through. And there's other times you say, it's not so rigid, you know. So the only thing I know is it helps to practice both, to work with your own mind and work with relationships simultaneously. And sometimes you may say, I really need to just work with accustoming myself to solitude. Because that's the other side. Some of us are really addicted to our extroversion. You know, as long as there's someone else around, we're safe. And you kind of, you know, my wife and I said this to each other, kind of trying to figure this out. It's like we each had been kind of around the block a bunch of times, so to speak. Do people still say that?
We still say that.
Yeah. And there was some sense of, like, I'm basically good without you, and I'm better with you. Not, like, essence-wise, but, like, it's a better path. And that's really powerful, and it definitely changes the practice. And I think the other thing is, if you enjoy and appreciate the insights of every phase of the practice, like... for me, like, there's an appreciation of, like, nobody's texting me back. There's an appreciation of the excitement at a connection. There's an appreciation of, like, this isn't going anywhere. There's an appreciation of this is going somewhere. There's an appreciation of the confusion of moving in with somebody. There's an appreciation of having to break up with the person you thought was your buttercup or stud muffin.
That I don't think we say anymore.
There's an appreciation of getting dumped. Everything can be part of the path awakening. There's an appreciation of, all right, let's do it. We're both here. Let's make this commitment. There's an appreciation of the long time to come. Every version of it can be part of the path of awakening, because every version of it is some kind of practice of relationship. So it's up to you. Yeah. But I don't think it's one or the other. There was a kind of simultaneity and interdependence between practicing with myself and practicing with others. And it really is like a pinball game. It's not like, one of my favorite lines from the Mahayana Buddhist teachings is a sutra that says, there is no pure and there is no impure. It's not going to be clean, and it's not going to be dirty either. It's just going to be kind of messy, beautiful life, and then somebody else is going to write a book about it. But that's the number one premise of my book, is there's no such thing as a relationship expert. That the term is literally an oxymoron, because relationship is at least two people, any form of relationship. Expert is one person, so literally relationship expert is an oxymoron. And I was talking to my dad about this, and he said, so are you trying to say, I didn't say this, he said this, he said, are you trying to say that the act of relating is relinquishing your expertise? And I said, that's exactly it. The act of a relationship is relinquishing your expertise.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bravo. It's a
great time. Bravo, David Nickturn. thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a great delight.
Always. Yeah. And thank you all so much for spending your evening practicing. And I'll see you again soon. Please. Okay.
Thank you.
Love it. Love it. Thanks for listening. Hey, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. But if you are in the New York City metropolitan area, come see us in person. Come to our weekly Dharma gathering, where these talks happen live every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. Check out our other classes and weekend programs. And email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org your questions, comments, suggestions, observations, love poems, anti-love poems, and keep hope alive. Later.